You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Yvette Brackman. She's in Copenhagen right now. Yvette, thanks so much for talking with me today.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
So Yvette, I'd love to know just what your studio is like in Copenhagen. I always think, have imagined that it's more romantic than it is, or maybe it is. But yeah, where is your studio? What does it look like, and what are you working on?
Well, my studio is actually my favorite place that I've had the whole time I've lived in Denmark. It's right smack in the center of Copenhagen, right next to what's called Nørreport Station. It's not like a huge romantic artist studio. It's a space about, I don't know, I've forgotten my feet now, but 130 square meters, and I share it with four other people, so three artists and a screenwriter. So we have one kind of common open space if we do sort of larger projects, but mostly I'd say it's a kind of, I don't know how many feet, I'd say, you know, I have my own private space, maybe 25 square meters, but it's a part of an open space. But the best thing about it is it's smack in the middle of the city, so it's a 10-minute bicycle ride from where I live, and, you know, when I need to get out, it's right across the street, just down the street from the Botanical Gardens. So today I was writing, and it was kind of intense writing, so I could take a break and just take a walk into the Botanical Gardens, which are really beautiful, and, you know, drink a cup of coffee, make some notes, and then walk back to my studio. So in that way, it's really idyllic.
That does sound as romantic as I imagine. And there's it's a biking city, right? There's been bikers everywhere.
Bikers, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, the city is just full of bikers. Today, I just got back from New York, and I bicycled home over this brand new bicycle and walking bridge that was just built that goes over the part of town that's called Newhavn over to Christianshavn, where I live. And, you know, it's just like those food trucks. It's very idyllic. You know, everybody's walking and bicycling. It's very nice. So I got to sort of experience the first ride across this newly built bridge. So that was really great.
So I want to talk about different projects of yours, but maybe we should just begin by talking about what you're doing in your studio or how you approach your work. And though I know you're in the middle of things, maybe just give a sense of that, and it sounds like it's through writing and moving around, perhaps. But what are you doing with your studio? And then we can talk about maybe a particular project that's been recently completed.
Yeah, well, recently I just at this point, you know, I just got back from 2 months in the States where I I curated a big exhibition up in Wisconsin together with another artist. Danish, but based in Chicago, whose name is Lisa Halle-Baggesen. And it was a place called the Poor Farm Experiment. So that was a really big project, which was curatorial, you know, 22 artists, 9 from Denmark, 11 from the United States. So it was very intensive.
Tell me a little bit about the Poor Farm, because I've interviewed Michelle Grabner, so... and that's in this series, and she talks a lot about, you know, how that was started. How was that to work with? Because that's an unusual American model, even.
Yeah, it was amazing. It was really fantastic. It was very communitarian, and that's one of the sort of things that I find very inspiring are those histories and traditions. We curated the sort of group show, the sort of largest part of the show, but there also were. There was a solo project that Michelle and Brad curated downstairs by an artist named Kate Newby and Hirschend. Now I'm just forgetting his first name. I'll remember it. But a really great filmmaker also showed the series of 11 videos he's made over the last 10, 15 years, or I think 11 years, I can't remember. But so there was a lot of different projects going on. But ours was the main kind of the bulk exhibition. It required a lot of coordination and preparation because, it's a really generous situation. You're offered this amazing, huge building, which is a former debtor's farm, half of it is exhibition space and the other half is sort of living space. And we were 40 with family, 40 people living in the building for between, you know, people arriving and going at different times, between 9 days and 3 days. And I had two students, recent graduates from Denmark, who were coming to the States anyway to do internships in New York. They came to do the cooking. So they coordinated all our meals, 3 meals a day. So that was really amazing, incredible cooks. So we were fed every day so people could all work and concentrate on doing the install. And we had a very intensive on the opening was Friday, and the Thursday before we had a full-day seminar, which was only for the artists to present work to each other and discuss our ideas and ideas around the exhibition. The exhibition was called Poor and Needy and was really focusing about questions of debt and migration. Everybody was sort of, so it was a long day and lots of interesting discussions. So we had that time of having that kind of like, which I think was really fantastic, really inspiring, was this opportunity when everybody's working on their work to actually get a chance to share what you're thinking about, what you're doing with each other. You know, usually everyone's like so stressed out before an opening that nobody really gets to like see each other's work because they're so worried about getting their own work up. So this was really like a huge gift, you know, that everybody got to talk with one another and share their ideas about their work. And then there was the opening the whole weekend.
That's fantastic. It sounds like such a great place. So how long were you there for in the entirety?
We arrived on Sunday the 31st, and then we left on Monday the 8th. That was Lisa and myself and my mom. I brought my mom with me. So it was a truly intergenerational experience. Lisa brought her daughter, Eleanor, who is 10, and I had my mom, who's my mom, so she's older. My mom gave a talk in the debtor's churchyard, which is still part of the property, where she gave a talk about Nikolai Gogol's Dead Souls as part of the opening events, the weekend events. So we had a lot of different events. We also had, on Sunday morning, we had a morning rave, which was DJed by Henrik Plenty Jakobsen from a distance. He wasn't able to come, but he sent us like a Detroit techno list that accompanied the paintings he showed. And we had Sophia Leivud on Saturday did writing analysis, because a lot of her painting has to do with, you know, different kinds of ways that we read text and image, and using a lot of these psychological tests, you know, like the duck rabbit test and all those kinds of things, the sort of Winnicott tests and things like that. So she had like everybody was really into this workshop. So we had this workshop, and, you know, everybody was coming up and like wanting to have their writing analyzed. I was told that I like to put things off to the last minute because I wrote a letter that went all the way to the bottom of the page. That's one of the analyses. We had
What your mother was doing. Your mother sounds really cool. She was. What was her reading about? And
well, she's a New Haven person. She's my mom. You know, she retired 2 years ago. She was teaching at the Slavic Languages Department, and her specialty is 19th and 20th century Russian literature. So especially Gogol, Dostoevsky, Chekhov, all those guys. It was a real gift to have her there. And it just came, what happened was that I was, before I went to the Poor Farm, I was in New Haven actually helping my mom move out of a house that she's lived in for many, many years into an apartment. And so she has a massive library. And one of the books I came across was Dead Souls, which is, it's incredible, incredible. You can't describe it. It's not a novel. It's kind of a epic poem. I don't know how you describe it. It's in its own category. But it's about anyway, it's a long story. It's about a man who collects, souls, but from gentry, Russian gentry, in order to become a nobleman. It's sort of in the period of Russia when there are serfs, and these landed gentry pay taxes for every soul in Russian. It's called a soul that they have on their land. So this kind of bureaucrat, this kind of lower middle management bureaucrat, comes up with this idea that if he goes around Russia and buys these souls off of the different gentry, and he collects enough of them, he can actually like bump up his status and become gentry himself and buy an estate. And, you know, before the next census happens and they find out that all these people are already dead. Does that make sense?
Oh my God. Yeah. Great story.
So I just thought, you know, when I picked up this book at my mom's house, I thought, this is amazing. This is so appropriate for this poor and needy topic that we're dealing with about debt and collecting debt and how, you know, how what we're dealing with today in this world that we live in. And so I thought, Mom, why don't you come and give a talk about dead souls as part of the program at the Poor Farm? And she said she'd love to. So so she came along, and she was really, you know, she was really, you know, kind of very important person there. People love talking to her, and So I also gave a presentation together with another artist named Annie Holm, who's based in Chicago. We talked about this Danish school system, which is this kind of very communitarian continuing education system called the Høj School, which is kind of the part of the Danish kind of Reformation and Enlightenment period, where a lot of reforms were made to sort of improve the status of the, you know, the farmers, and this kind of open school system continues today. There are many, many of these schools all over Denmark, and it's a kind of a way of living and learning how to be together, how to be, you know, share responsibilities, but also, you know, learn new skills, new knowledge, but also about how to be a community, how to share responsibility. So we talked about one of these schools, which is called Krabbesholm Høj School, which is a really interesting art and design and architecture Høj School based in Denmark that invites artists to do projects, and they've invited lots of really interesting artists from Dan Grant.
How did you get there? I mean, I don't want to talk about maybe another recent project. That's certainly a big one, the Poor Farm. How did you get to Copenhagen as a? I mean, are you an expat now? Do you see yourself that way?
As an expat? Oh, I don't know. I don't think. I don't know. I mean, I don't think I define myself either way. I mean, I feel at home here and I feel at home there. I feel at home anywhere I go. It's kind of a crazy thing. But I've been here and I have, you know, family ties here and friendship ties here, and also, a lot of my work, I mean, the majority of my career has been here in Denmark, because I left when it was 2000. So I was, 29. Almost 30 years old. So, but I would say what brought me to Denmark, well, there's a lot of different things, and it's also always, in hindsight, you can kind of make a narrative out of it. But it started with meeting some artists and gallerists and curators first in Basel, at the first Liste art fair. I met the gallerist Nikolai Velna and the now well-known curator, but at that time working together with Nikolai, Jakob Fabricius, and also some of the artists that showed with them. So there were a lot of, I was just very inspired by the work that they were showing. Peter Land, Henrik Plinge Jakobsen, Gita Wielussen, Jakob Colling. I was working and I had a job working at Parquet, developing their editions. And I was also, making my own work and, you know, trying to make ends meet in New York, writing articles, teaching art history, you know, doing all kinds of jobs, writing blurbs for Thea Westreich's art collection, you know, all kinds of jobs. I was showing in some group shows at Green Naftali and different curated programs at David Zwirner but I was, you know, I was trying to figure out, you know, where does my work fit? And when I saw in the American kind of gallery system, and I think I was just really inspired to see that a lot of this work was very performative, video based, working with different kind of social issues. The next thing I knew, I got invited to come to Denmark to do some projects. And the first project, actually the big project, was at this school, this Krabbesholm High School that I mentioned earlier. And then that led to some teaching gigs, which eventually led to me applying and getting a job as a professor at the Royal Danish Art Academy in 2001. I also got a really wonderful exhibition at the National Gallery, the Danish National Gallery, in their project room called the X Room, which was a really big project. It was the biggest project I ever had and the first project that I had at a museum. And that was also in 2001. So just, I mean, lots of really exciting things were happening here, and exciting things were also happening in New York, but they were just, you know, it was, more and more things were happening here. And then I met my husband, and I think that clinched it.
Because he's, yeah. Why, is he Danish or he lives there?
He's Danish. Yeah, he's Danish and he lives here. So I think the combination of, you know, meeting my husband and then also getting a full-time teaching job at the Royal Danish Academy, which was also a really super exciting job because it was helping to, you know, renew a department. It was called the Department of Walls and Space. And it was, you know, they really wanted to have artists and projects that were more based in socially engaged practice, relational aesthetics, you know, performance, publicly involved projects and so on. So I got hired to do that job, to head this department, and was able to invite tons of artists and you know, develop programs, and so that was a really exciting period in terms of teaching. But they don't have tenure here, so that I did that job for almost 8 years and finished in June 2007. But you know, by then I was, you know, I have my gave birth to my daughter in 2002. And then that was, you know, the transition to having Copenhagen as a base. Yeah.
Long story. I'm glad you said all that, because it's interesting how you make that transition also. So then you raised your daughter and you're still doing that. And in terms of your art there, you're continuing to show like post, you know, having your daughter and doing that and living in Copenhagen, just to get the sense of the support for the arts there and how you continued, you were able to keep making art as well as raising a family.
Yeah.
And
absolutely. I mean, I think, depending on the different phases of my daughter's, ages, there were different things that I was producing. It's interesting for me sometimes to look back that I was doing a lot more video. Now I'm doing a lot more sculptural work, a lot more installation work and studio-based work. But when she was small, I was doing a lot more video because it was something I could do on the computer, you know, when she was asleep and, you know, take breaks and take with me wherever, you know, she was. So it's interesting to see that those phases. But I was continuously making work through the whole period. Yeah.
And how is that supported there? I mean, obviously, you know, I went through the same thing, or still am, had a kid, and trying to figure out how to continue making work and be supported for that. In Copenhagen, is there a support system for the arts that's markedly different than the United States?
Yeah, I mean, there's an unbelievable support system. I mean, it's just, incredible. It started in the late 80s. It's called the Danish Arts Fund, and it's actually part of the Danish kind of constitution that, you know, that the arts must be supported. It's kind of amazing. I don't know if it's a constitution, but, you know, it's actually written into law as that the arts must be supported and that they're important for culture. So you can apply for production grants. You can apply for travel grants. They actually have, you can get it once, a 3-year work grant where you actually get, a salary. Or it's not, it's not counted as a salary in terms of hours, but you get the equivalent of, I don't know, $40,000 or something like that for a period of 3 years. Those only 6 people get that a year, and then they get it for a 3-year period. But lots of people get smaller amounts, you know. Between 50 and 150,000 krona, so it'd be between 10 and 25,000 krona people can apply for. You know, they write in and talk about what projects they're working on. I think it's what the NEA used to be, you know, before it got completely, you know, destroyed by Jesse Helms or whoever he is now.
Right. That's amazing. Well, I don't think it was ever quite at that stage, but that's quite remarkable. And to do that, obviously, you have to be a Danish citizen, or?
No, actually, it's kind of amazing. I mean, I've gotten those grants, and it's not. But you do have to have your main production in Denmark. So even artists who are maybe, either you have to be Danish, and showing your work in Denmark or, but living in Berlin or New York or whatever. But you can also be, you don't have to be a Danish citizen. But if you've been living here and contributing, and working here and part of the Danish art scene, you can apply and you have a possibility of getting it regardless of your nationality.
Amazing. Yeah, that's so exciting to hear. I hope the United States starts moving towards that rapidly.
Yeah, I do too. I really do too. But I'm also to say also that it was just really an honor and a pleasure to work with artists in terms of the exhibition we did in Wisconsin. I mean the work, regardless, in the United States, amazing work. People are doing amazing work, and people, that it's not the money that makes the work great. I think people, produce really, and yeah, I mean, there's,
well, that's a good question. I mean, the money doesn't make the work, but still, the support for art, I mean, I think allows it to flourish, perhaps in a different way. I mean, in New York, for example, the yoke of just the rent is so extreme that it's hard to continue to make art for many. So I don't know. I mean, maybe I'm wrong. What do you think? Is support like that important? State support for cultural growth, or is there some advantage to not having that kind of support?
Oh, I think it's, I mean, I think what I mean to say is I think state support is fantastic and important, and I would always, advocate that it on so many levels, that it's not only about the production of the work, it's about the cultural exchange, it's about the possibilities of what can, what you can do that sort of are outside of the commercial market. That aren't dictated by the constraints of the commercial market necessarily. Not that, I mean, I think also interesting things can be done within, a commercial context. I think I was talking, John Hirschend, that's what I was, I was talking with him. He has this project, now I'm just blanking what it's called, but it's in San Francisco. He does additions as issues. And, sometimes, these questions of sponsorship, larger sponsorship companies that want to, sponsor things because it's in their interest to do things cultural But I mean, I still think you can do really great work that way. But I think if you have something that's state supported, there are just a lot of ways that you can work that maybe you're more limited with if you are working independently and don't have that larger infrastructure support. Mm. But I mean, I think what's interesting, on the bottom line, I believe in artists, and I believe in artists' ingenuity and their the drive for creativity to communicate. I think, often you also see how creative, how creative artists are to make their work and to show it, and how many ways they find to do it, regardless of if the funding is there or not. And I think often, what's happening in New York, I don't know the statistics of it, but I mean, I wonder how much of the work that's being shown in New York is being produced in New York today compared to 25 years ago.
Right, that's true.
Maybe it's still being shown there, but I'm sure that it's being produced, maybe in Bridgeport or in, I don't know where, but, artists have to find ways to survive to do their work. So people have to, move out and find other solutions to the Lower East Side is not the same Lower East Side as it used to be in terms of.
Absolutely.
That. Yeah. Yeah.
That's true. So it's great talking to you about all this, and makes me wish I was living in Copenhagen or perhaps I will one day. We've talked about a number
that
of things.
That would be great.
Before we go, is there another project that you've done recently that we should talk about or you should mention before we go?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the cycle that I'm completing right now is this project called Agit Mem, and it's a project that has to do with my family history. And the final kind of part of it is a video version of a play that I've written together with a family constellations therapist and a poet. It's very much inspired by Russian constructivism, and it consists of the performance is a reading of a newspaper version of the play. So the play is in a newspaper. The title Agit Mem refers to agit prop, but some replacing the agitational propaganda, which was, in the 30s in the Soviet Union. But I've replaced the propaganda with memory, so agitational memory. So agit mem as opposed to agit prop. And it's I've taken as a kind of skeleton the play from 1913 that Krucinyak and Malevich and Khlebnikov wrote called The Victory Over the Sun. And I kind of used the structure, which was about this kind of, it's this sort of futurist play of the destruction of the world. And all the pieces of the world that sort of get ripped apart. And I sort of take those pieces that were ripped apart, because my family background is Russian, as being what happens like after the victory over the sun. So Agit Mem is kind of my idea of the continuation, what happened to all those people and pieces that were ripped apart and flung all over the world continued. So,
and so the installation is pieces of material or something on the walls? Or
yeah, well, they're, the installation is 11 costumes, which look like panels. I always work with these sort of fabric panels that have these sort of multifunction. I mean, and I've been doing that since the mid-90s, these sort of textile pieces that can both be like walls and blankets and also robes. And so they function both as costumes for the performers, but then they also hang on the wall as objects in terms of an exhibition context. Kind of like Japanese robes, they sort of hang on a pole. And in the performance, in the video, the video's cut into it's all done from filmed from a crane. The overall views where all the actors are in costume and they're reading the play in the newspaper. So it kind of looks almost like a kind of, I don't know, like imagine like our town stage scene of people reading the newspaper in a kind of white kind of, how do you call it? Some endless horizon room, you know, these kind of rooms for commercials that are, you don't see the edges of the room.
Sure.
And then there, and then inlaid, kind of superimposed on that overall scene of all these actors in costume, I have close-ups of the actors up front, close up to the camera, where they read their lines, and they kind of come in and out of the and superimpose themselves onto the overall scene as each line is read. So that's the final, that piece I just completed. Actually, it's not quite completed. Doing the last subtitling of it. So, yeah, that'll be complete here in the next few weeks. And I had the...
And where will that be produced? That'll be produced somewhere.
Well, actually, it's going to be part of the Danish National Gallery's collection. So it hasn't been shown.
They're acquiring the work, so to speak.
They're acquiring that work together, and they've already acquired 5 costumes. So they'll show that together with the newspaper, which is going to be a mounted version of the newspaper. Done in terms of the registration of the newspaper. I wanted to refer back to the constructivist methods of revealing the modes of production, where the layout of the newspaper is such that if you take 2 newspapers and lay them out, you can see the registration. I forgot what it's called. I think they're called, but you know, the registrations.
Marks on there or something, yeah, the guides.
Not the guides, but, you know, when you print a newspaper, you print them on large print sheets, so you actually usually have 4 layouts to a plate. So when you lay it out on the... So you can see this kind of... you can see this kind of print method. So
the printer's right. The printer's master, sort of, before it can fold it in.
Exactly, the printer's master. If you lay 2 of those newspapers together and lay them all out side by side, it reveals it's about 6 feet by 8 feet in the total of all the pages of the. I think it's 18 pages, 18 layouts. It reveals reverse eclipse. So instead of it reveals a white circle kind of blocking out a back black, dark background, sort of. So it's, and I'm kind of in that referring to this kind of the victory over the sun in 13. They were actually... 3 solar eclipses that year, and they were, because it was like the new century, there was a lot of kind of superstition around these issues about the eclipse and futurism and the revolution and everything that was happening. And actually, when I produced this work, it was also, there were also eclipses over the Faroe Islands and in Germany and in Ireland, or Scotland, I think. They were, so this is kind of complementing back to that, victory over the sun in terms of it being, instead of it being a solar eclipse, this is a reverse eclipse. So it's kind of the sun shining and blocking out the darkness, as opposed to the darkness blocking out the light.
I like that. That's cool. Yeah, that's good. It's hard to visualize all these things that I envision this, you know, as I interview people, but I think that's clear. And before we go, I wanted to ask you what books you're reading now, or book, or if you would share that with us.
Well, I'm reading a whole bunch of books right now. I'm really interested in the African and African American presence in Russia, and in the Cold War, and earlier on. I'm reading a book called The Communist Challenge to Africa by Ian Gregg, which is about, you know, just about the policies that were going on in after the Second World War up into the 70s, 80s, and, you know, Cuban Soviet policies. And I'm starting to work I have been working on a while, but my next project is going to be around, communist era and the relationship to sort of Black identity and Jewish identity. I'm also reading a book about Carl Einstein, who also wrote a lot about African sculpture in the 20s. He was one of these sort of documents. What's this book called? It's called by David Quigley, Carl Einstein, A Defense of the Real. And then I'm reading Langston Hughes's I Wonder as I Wander. It's an autobiography of Langston Hughes. Some of the books I'm reading, I hop around a lot. You know, it's like kind of depending on what, like, oh, I'm going to read something more poetic. I'm reading something really dry. So, yeah.
That's great. I'm glad you shared that. Yeah, Langston Hughes is an amazing poet. You know, my mother used to read me. I remember one of his poems when I was a kid. It was Life Ain't No Crystal Stair.
Yeah.
Wow. I read that.
Wow, that's beautiful.
Well, it's a beautiful poem, though. Yeah.
Beautiful. Wow.
Yvette, I want to thank you for talking with me today. It's really been a pleasure hearing about your work.
Thank you. Thank you.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.